Welcome to Cancer Conference Update, ESMO Congress 2025. Today, we're focusing on prostate cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Raina McKay from the UC San Diego Moores Cancer Center in San Diego, California, for her thoughts and some of the key presentations on prostate cancer.
Out of all the prostate cancer studies that were presented at the meeting, I think the most impactful are the overall survival data from the EMBARK trial. And actually, when the data were presented and the Kaplan-Meier curves were put up for people to review, the room fell into an applause. And so I think it really drives home that intermittent therapy escalation for this high-risk population really is driving an OS benefit. We haven't seen hazard ratios for overall survival this dramatic in this setting in a long time. The hazard ratio for OS was 0.6, 0.597 from the data. The 8-year OS rate, 78.9 compared to 69.5. And keep in mind, this is overall survival, not necessarily just death from prostate cancer. ADT can certainly be associated with various, cardiovascular risk and other things like that. But clearly, these patients are deriving long-term benefit. And the trial is intermittent therapy. After a year of therapy for those individuals that hit a PSA of 0.2, they were permitted to discontinue treatment. For those that did not, they remained on continuous therapy. And I think that's a point that we need to continue to reinforce. And so I think this, it's going to be really hard to beat this combination in this setting. I mean, this data are really impressive.
So, of course, we can't go without talking about enzalutamide monotherapy. They also looked at survival. Looks like they didn't see quite as much of a benefit there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the take-home message for the enza monotherapy is that there doesn't appear to be a statistically significant difference compared to Lupron alone in this context. And I think it's just great to have this data around monotherapy out there. You know, there are some individuals that are just not great candidates for ADT or prefer to not do ADT. And I think having data of an anti-androgen alone, is really great to be able to showcase this and highlight this. So I think it is an option for select individuals that can't get doublet therapy.
Yeah, I mean, and intermittent enza alone also at that. And, I guess, even though it looks like even the survival is not better than LHRH agonist alone, LHRH agonist was the standard for 20 years. And it turns out that taking a pill, at least it seems pretty similar.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think it's going to be interesting. And I'd love to see additional data from EMBARK around this, time to T recovery, the rates of, the PSA nadir rates in both of those cohorts, who stopped the enza at the 1-year mark, what was their T recovery like? Because T recovery impacts, a biochemical recurrence. So I think understanding those dynamics in the LHRH arm versus the enza mono is going to be really important. This was top line data. So I think, no other study got a applause when the KM curve was put up in the prostate space as this one. The PRESTO study was a cooperative group trial that was done for patients that had high-risk biochemical recurrent prostate cancer. The study was designed to include only patients that had a prior radical prostatectomy, which is a little bit different than EMBARK, which included all-comer patients who had an RP or had definitive radiation as their primary modality. They needed to have a PSA greater than 0.5, and the PSA doubling time threshold here was 9 months. And patients were randomized to one of three arms, either an LHRH analog alone or LHRH analog with APA or LHRH analog with APA plus ABI. And the primary endpoint of the trial was biochemical progression-free survival. So it was a PSA metric. And we saw previous data that were presented on that primary metric. And then a key secondary endpoint was metastasis-free survival, and the study was actually amended and modified to allow for long-term follow-up and collection of data around MFS. So I think it's really excellent to see the MFS data, given that that's where we see the correlation between overall survival. It's with MFS as opposed to a biochemical endpoint. So we did see a signal that MFS was longer in the APA-treated patients compared to the LHRH analog, though this did not reach, statistical significance. And I think really the study wasn't powered to look at this as a primary endpoint, so we just have to keep that in mind. I do think the data are mature. 41% of patients had MFS events in the context of the study. So we do see that signal, but it's just not as pronounced. And then with regards to toxicity, I don't think there was really anything new that was gleaned. You know, this was a three-arm study. I think the big take home is probably the triplet is too much. We're not seeing additional efficacy gains in this context and more toxicity. And I think that kind of pans out in other studies that have looked at Abby plus anti-androgen, that they, you know, I think we were all really optimistic and eager that those studies were going to be positive, but they just were not.
So I guess you're kind of in a situation of indirectly comparing Presto and Embark. Can you talk about how you see that and whether there's any role right now for apalutamide in this situation?
Yeah, very good question. You know, I think you cannot replace a large phase three that's, hundreds of patients with a very strong MFS and OS signal. Like it's just, the data are just too good. You know what I mean? So I don't necessarily think it's going to replace, but I think there are some people that may have drug-drug interactions with enzalutamide. They're on a DOAC. They can't get off the DOAC. There's other things to consider. So I think this data reinforced that yes, apalutamide, does work as well. Like, do I think that there's probably more similarities than there are differences with these drugs. And so there may be some nuances where you may want to use APA over ENZA.
Incidentally, do we know anything about the current, incidence of M0 with PSMA testing out there now? Or all, I've heard people say all these people in Embark would have been positive on PSMA.
Yeah, so there was actually a single institution analysis out of UCLA that took an Embark-like population and actually looked at the likelihood that these patients would have had METs using PSMA PET imaging as opposed to conventional imaging, which is what was utilized in Embark. And it was, I think over 80% of individuals would have had a positive PSMA PET scan. So I think we need to take that into context. The other thing when Embark was designed is patients and clinicians were blinded to the PSA results. So, which is also another layer. And I think that probably help mitigate people doing stuff later on in the trial based off of PSA that could have impacted the primary endpoint readout.
So one final question, getting back to Embark and intermittent strategy, is I wonder whether or not you're using intermittent therapy more in patients who have metastatic disease, particularly, let's just say, if they're PSMA only positive. You know, there was this thing in the past that we used to talk about in CME programs. You can use intermittent M0, but not in metastatic. Is that sort of still hold true, or are you using intermittent and metastatic also?
You know, I think for those individuals, I guess it's complicated. If they're conventional imaging negative, they're PSMA PET positive. You know, I think we have to think long and hard about keeping these people on dual ADT for an indefinite period of time. These are people that were not captured in these trials. These patients are probably lower risk. And now we're integrating like metastasis-directed therapy. So if I have a patient who's conventional imaging negative, PSMA PET positive, they've undergone metastasis-directed therapy, like, they're a great individual for, okay, short-term escalated therapy and then stop and let's see what happens. And so I think those studies are currently ongoing, looking at strategies like that for PSMA PET positive disease.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. In CLL, they came up with this term time-limited therapy, which, in the past has been with like venetoclax and anti-CD20. Mm. And the general oncologist kind of picked up on that, and they started to use that term outside of CLL. And in a way, that's, I guess you could say what you're talking about potentially would be time-limited therapy. You stop when they're responding and see what happens. Yeah. Seeing that in metastatic colon, they give people vacations, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know if that's going to be more utilized in prostate cancer.
I mean, hopefully so. In this, like, the biochemical recurrent space is a very heterogeneous space, and I think continuous forever intensified therapy is not the strategy. The saruparib study was a phase 1-2 study that was looking at saruparib with various androgen receptor pathway inhibitors. And this study was basically designed with multiple different combinations in multiple different settings, irrespective of HRR gene status. So it was a very heterogeneous patient population. So it enrolled patients that were mCRPC, mHSPC, both de novo and recurrent, and again, irrespective of HRR status. The primary endpoint was really to look at adverse event profile and toxicity. And there were cohorts in combination with Abby. There were cohorts in combination with darolutamide and cohorts in combination with enzalutamide, and the data not presented with a cohort with APA. And saruparib is a selective PARP1 inhibitor as opposed to a PARP1-2 inhibitor like olaparib is and some of the other PARP inhibitors. And so the thought and rationale is that there's potentially going to be less hematologic toxicity with saruparib given its selectivity to PARP1. And I think overall we saw a fairly well manageable like side effect profile when we look at the AEs. I think the big ones that really draw our attention are the cytopenias, so rates of grade 3 or higher anemia around 20%, neutropenia 10%, platelet count decreased is really actually quite low, getting down into the grade 3, which grade 3 would be a platelet count less than 50K, lymphocyte count decrease that we saw. So I think overall manageable side effect profile. You know, I think it's difficult to interpret the efficacy data just because there's so many different contexts in which the drugs were, saruparib was tested in various different combinations. And so, and then when you look at the response data, for example, it's only for those that had measurable disease. So in some of the groups that were analyzed, there was like, 9 or 8 patients. So the sample size wasn't very large. But I think the data are promising that there is manageable toxicity profile, manageable AE profile. There's saruparib seems to be easily combinable with the other RPs, no negative AE signal. And in the mHSPC setting, really saw dramatic PSA 90 levels or undetectable PSAs. Which is nice to see. Now, it's hard to do cross-trial comparisons in this context, but I think the data are quite promising. There's a couple of trials that are being launched. EvoPAR-01 is looking at saruparib in the mHSPC setting, and actually EvoPAR-02 is looking at saruparib in the setting adjuvant to radiation in patients that are BRCA1/2 deficient. EvoPAR-1 is an unselective trial. EvoPAR-2 is a selective, localized trial.
Before we go on to the other one, could you just put in context in terms of, again, what we saw at the ASCO meeting looking at niraparib and whether you think that's sort of ready for prime time now?
Yeah, no, very good question. I think at ASCO, we saw data that were presented by Gert Attard around the combination of niraparib with abiraterone in the mHSPC setting in a biomarker-selected population and looking at the benefit, particularly for those BRCA1/2 patients that really seem to have a dramatic improvement with regards to RPFS. So I think the data are, I think BRCA-mutated patients need more. I think they're highly sensitive to PARP inhibition. And in multiple contexts, we've demonstrated that early PARP actually improves their outcomes. I think there's some lingering questions regarding, duration of therapy, how long do you keep the PARP going, kind of long-term tox that we'll need to sort of glean from the, additional follow-up from the Amplitude trial. But I think this is where the field should be moving towards, biomarker-selected strategies for those high-risk individuals. So this data builds upon that.
Have you actually done this yourself or attempted to do this in outside a clinical trial?
Not yet, not necessarily treating an individual in the hormone sensitive setting, metastatic hormone sensitive setting with a PARP inhibitor. We actually just recently closed a neoadjuvant study that we had open with olaparib with ADT for those high risk individuals that are positive for HRR with localized disease to see a signal of activity in the pathologic specimen from radical prostatectomy. That study is ongoing to analyze the primary endpoint of pathologic response.
So you have a patient comes in with hormone sensitive metastatic disease who's a medical oncologist, says, I'd like to get a PARP inhibitor.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely a discussion worth having. This is exactly the patient that I would escalate. And I think, even though right now there isn't an FDA approval that's come through, I think this is exactly the conversations that need to be had. And it's definitely something that I would be, willing to consider in somebody who's BRCA1/2 mutated, given the negative prognosis that are associated with these individuals. The longer we can keep them hormone sensitive, the better.
So what about this data from the TELEPRO-2 study looking at telazoprib plus enzalutamide? Any thoughts about that? What did they see there?
Yeah, and I think this is, a subset analysis for those individuals that had measurable disease for which objective response could be, determined. So the reason that the sample size is smaller here is because doesn't include those bone-only patients or patients with non-measurable disease. And I think really the take-home message is in the HRR-deficient cohort, we're seeing a really, short time to response and sustained response, over 20 months for durability of response with the combination of enzalutamide and talazoprib. So I think this just continues to reinforce the role of combination therapy for HRR mutated individuals in the mCRPC setting.
Does it make you want to use it earlier?
Potentially, I think TALAPRO-3 is going to be looking at that and looking at the use of talazoprib enzalutamide in the mHSPC setting. So I think we're all eagerly awaiting the results. I think the label for talazoprib enzalutamide is broader than with the other PARP inhibitors. It encompasses all HRR-altered individuals, not just BRCA1/2. And there were about, 50 patients on this trial that had received a prior ARPI. And there's another study called the TALENT trial that's looking at enza TALA in ARPI pretreated mCRPC patients. So we'll get additional data on this combination for ARPI-exposed individuals, which is, a large proportion of the mCRPC patients now that we see.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. McKay, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Cancer Conference Update.